From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn.
Good morning and welcome to the very first regular broadcast day of WHQR-FM, Wilmington, North Carolina. WHQR-FM transmits on a frequency of 91.3 megahertz at an effective radiated power.
Station manager Michael Titterton introduced the new public radio station to the community on April 22, 1984. It was the first to serve southeastern North Carolina.
Many of you listening this morning are members of Friends of Public Radio and are aware of the various problems the organization has encountered during the gestation period of this radio station. The dedication and drive you've shown in overcoming these obstacles is no doubt also responsible for your waking up this early on a Sunday morning to listen to this broadcast. Friends of Public Radio and the dream of this radio station have been in existence now for almost 5 years. Now, 5 years is a long time to wait for anything. It's even longer when you're being asked to contribute your time and money to a venture which may or may not materialize.
As we prepare to celebrate WHQR 35 years later, we thought it appropriate to meet and talk with some of the people who were instrumental in the station's birth and growth. In three different segments, we'll meet key people who had a hand in shaping the station's legacy. And while this is something of a history lesson, it's also a demonstration of what a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens has been able to do. Whether it's changed the world, as anthropologist Margaret Mead suggested such a group could, well, that's for you to decide. Today's journey through station history is organized chronologically from the earliest to today. In segment three, we'll hear from current station manager Michelle Rinesmith and former board member Jeff Hovis. In the second segment, former board president Barbara Sullivan and operations manager George Scheibner join us. But right now, we're going to meet some of the first people responsible for launching WHQR and starting its legacy. Jerry Nolan was a founding member and part of the station's first advocacy group, Friends of the Opera. Dr. Jerry Nolan, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you very much.
Sharon Mahoney is WHQR's first news director, and she launched local news when the station opened on Greenfield Street. Sharon Mahoney, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much.
And today's conversation is pre-recorded. Jerry Nolan, take us back to the development, the creation of Friends of the Opera. You moved here in 1978, taking a job as a doctor in the emergency room at what is now New Hanover Regional Medical Center.
That is correct.
And then Friends of the Opera grew up. How did that happen?
Well, it's probably saying too much to say that I might not have come here if I hadn't been able to hear the Saturday afternoon operas, because that's been very important to me since my youth. But I was assured that we could hear the opera on the radio station, whatever it was. I can't remember now. So I decided to come anyway.
There was another radio station that played the opera,
yeah,
the Metropolitan Opera.
Yeah, it was a commercial AM station with a leaning toward beach music. And they finally decided the opera wasn't what they really wanted to do anymore. So one morning we all got up and listened. I mean, one Saturday morning we all tried to turn on the opera and nothing doing. And this was a great shock. So many of us called the radio station to be told that there was no more chance for the opera. And we also wrote letters to the editor and asking for like-minded people to join up and see what we could manage. Of course, we had no idea of making a public radio station, none. All we wanted to do was to get the opera back on Saturday afternoons. And that's why we called ourselves the Friends of Opera originally.
And at what point did it morph from Friends of the Opera into Friends of Public Radio?
I think I would think about 1980.
So this is 4 years before the station actually went on the
air.
Oh,
yeah, 4 long years, right.
And you hired the first station manager, Michael Titterton, during that time as part of that
exactly.
effort.
Exactly. I was at that time the nominal treasurer, so I was Michael's paymaster. So in the early days, we were so casual that Michael used to come to my house every 2 weeks, and I'd give him his paycheck, and then we'd have dinner.
Why did it take 5 years? That's what he says in his introduction. It took 5 years to go from the idea to actually getting WHQR on the air.
Right. Well, it was a much bigger venture than most of us who had signed on originally to be a friend of the opera. It was a much bigger venture than we had dreamed of. And we never could have done it without some of the other people that came on board later, such as John Tiedemann, who was a huge asset, as well as some of the other folks. And it required a lot of doing, because first of all, you had to have an organization that was approved by National Public Radio before you could even think about getting going. Then you had to have money, and so on and so on. And then came the technical parts of it. It was a long, involved process, but it worked.
It worked, and that was despite a feasibility study that was commissioned by your group that came back negative and
exactly.
said, sorry, this community can't support such an endeavor. You
yeah.
did it anyway.
Yeah, as the then president of Friends of Public Radio, Teddy Stickney, was quoted as saying, we didn't know enough to know we couldn't do it.
So Michael Titterton then hired you, Sharon Mahoney, the first news director of WHQR. When was that?
Well, it wasn't very long at all before we went on the air.
So it was soon after that. Local news was intended to be a part of the station.
Yes.
And how did you approach that? You were coming from TV.
Well, I had studied journalism, and I had worked at public radio and college as, you know, volunteer. And so anyway, I viewed this as an incredible opportunity, and being able to do everything, even though it seems like now you think about it, well, that's crazy. One person doing all the news is insane. Shoestring budget, but I was willing. I was willing to get out there and take it on. It was a lot of learning. We had some moments that weren't so wonderful on air. Our very first and only live call-in show was a disaster. Because
you had one live call-in show, and that was enough.
That was it.
What happened?
Well, I wasn't very familiar with the local accent. And this gentleman called in, and he kept going on and on about the Baccarat. And I could not for the life of me understand what he was referring to, so I kept asking him, I'm sorry, Baccarat? Baccarat? And this went on and on until finally Trish Schneider held up a sign in the control room, Tobacco Crop. It was horrifyingly embarrassing, and that we never tried another live call-in show again.
And then not too many months after you joined the station, I think Hurricane Diana blew through.
Right. That was the big story. And, you know, we went from being a fledgling little baby public radio station to being on Morning Edition and All Things Considered all the time. And
you were talking to NPR at that point.
Oh, yes. Yes, and when the hurricane actually hit, I was doing reports from my home, it was kind of strange and exciting at the same time to hear my voice on National Public Radio. And I always still remember the tagline, for reporting for National Public Radio, this is Sharon Mahoney in Wilmington, North Carolina. When they got to hear from me more, because after I did leave the station, were places I went, the hurricanes always followed me. And I believe it was Carl Castle. It may have been someone else, but I believe he gave me the nickname Hurricane Mahoney. And that has stuck. So I'm still known in certain areas as Hurricane Mahoney to this day.
And you wound up covering other storms after that.
Yes.
In Wilmington, North Carolina?
Or? In Miami, Florida, and down in the islands in Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands. So they just followed me around.
There was a guy who came to the station as an intern and started at the station as a UNCW intern. Is that right? It was through the university, or?
I'm not really sure how Jim came to us, and it was not me who found him, but Jim Polson did work with us as an intern. He was already fairly well seasoned. He was not a young kid. And he went on to have a very successful career in New York. He worked for Bloomberg News. So he stayed in the news business for the rest of his career. And he was fabulous because he had a very, very good knack with the language. And he was very unassuming. So he would be able to interview people and they would tell him anything. And it was wonderful. And it was great to have that help, because without the help, you know, I did the cut-ins to Good Morning Morning Edition, and you know, I would do a noon news. I did a half hour noon broadcast, and but he would let us do some outside things and go get some Nat sound and get some kind of the flavor of the community. So it was really great to have Jim.
You're listening to Coastline. It's a look at WHQR's sometimes unbelievable, often inspiring, community-directed destiny. April 22nd, 2019 is when it celebrates its 35th birthday. And while it's thriving now, it's not without some moments when people thought it might be the end of the road. With us now, Jerry Nolan. He's one of the founders and original members of Friends of the Opera. Sharon Mahoney is WHQR's first news director. Today's discussion is pre-recorded. Jerry Nolan, Norman Bemelmans was the first music director at WHQR.
Yes, he was.
And he had his own show.
Yes, he did. It was not classical music by any means. It was called Greenfield at 4, and it was just a hodgepodge of Norman Bemelmans' quirky sense of humor. And I remember I used to occasionally run across something I thought was going to be screamingly funny, and I would submit it to him, and he would dutifully play it on Greenfield at 4.
And one of your important co-workers, Sharon Mahoney, it was just the two of you in the newsroom, Jim Polson and you. You didn't get a chance to see the newsroom grow until after you left the station. Is that right?
That is correct. In fact, when I left, they no longer did news. They didn't do news at all. They did some cultural affairs programming, but news was gone.
The news department died when you left.
I was it. And, you know, I took an opportunity. I was recruited by Channel 6 to be the executive producer of the 6 and 11 o'clock newscast. It was a great opportunity to advance, and so I took it. But I always have felt a little bittersweet about that, because WHQR was such a fantastic place to work, and I got to grow tremendously. No, they didn't do any news. And for many years afterward, it was mainly just they did a cultural calendar. So when you all started really getting into local news again, I was over the moon. I was over the moon happy. Sorry about the tapping.
That's okay.
But it's amazing to see, you know, you've got a great team now. You do go out, you get real news coverage again, and not just art gallery openings. It's wonderful.
Although the art gallery openings are very important.
Right.
Jerry Nolan.
I was just going to say, I used to feel very proud when I would hear somebody like you signing off for WHQR, National Public Radio, and that would make me get a little bit choked up. Much as I did when I heard the Toccata and Fugue on the opening note of the program, and I even got a little touchy this morning.
Yeah, it was a big effort over a long period of time.
Yes.
And
who chose that piece?
I think Michael.
I love that. That's one of my favorites, and it's strange because I didn't come from a classical music background as you did, although I've always loved music, and Bach was my favorite composer. So I love your music cut-ins on Coastline, because there's quite a bit of Bach in there too. So that kind of takes me back when I hear that, Rachel.
I'm glad to hear that. We do honor our classical music legacy here, although the station is now split into two different dedicated stations, all classical and all news. Sharon, you told us a story about
editing some boring parts out of, was it Beethoven?
Oh, yes.
And Norman Bemelmans, I guess, was not so happy about that.
Yes, I was going to take a trip to Florida, so it was going to be quite a long road trip. So I was in the control room, and I did a lot of editing because I would do interviews, and I would edit them out, edit out the bad stuff, the boring stuff, and keep the good stuff. So I decided to do the same thing with some Beethoven symphonies. And originally, my mom and dad, Jim and Peggy Mahoney, they donated the complete works of both Beethoven and Mozart, and that was primarily what the station started with, music-wise. So, yeah, I did. It wasn't that I didn't like the Andantes. It was a drive tape, so I wanted it to be snappy, you know, to keep me awake on the highway. And Norman Bemelmans came in, you know, he was in the studio looking across the glass, and he was like this, you know, with a stern look he could get sometimes, his Tyrolean glare. And he came into the studio. He said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm just, you're taking out the boring parts." I don't think he spoke to me for 2 weeks, unless he had to. But we eventually got over it. We patched it up over a beer.
Well, that's okay, Sharon. When I did a Saturday afternoon fundraising broadcast here at the station, I developed a specialty of paring down operas, cutting out the boring parts, and so I could get them in the segments that I had time for. So yeah, I edited operas pretty sharply.
Mary Thompson wrote to us with this remembrance. She says, "It's hard to put into words what WHQR means to me. I remember hearing the sound of the newborn baby cry the first moment the station signed on the air. I loved serving on the board of directors for 2 terms in the early years at Greenfield Street and answering the phones for pledge drives and meeting many wonderful and interesting people. Above all, enjoying the great programming from Bob Edwards on Morning Edition to Car Talk to Science Friday to excellent local programs and many, many more." Thank you so much for writing in, Mary. And Sharon, if we have time, I want to get to a story. You were covering politics, and there was a very well-known senator in town. You went to an event.
Yes.
Tell us what happened.
Well, it was Senator Jesse Helms, and he was at an event at Wrightsville Beach. And so I had my own little stereo recorder. Michael insisted I use that rather than the station provided one because it was stereo. And you could hear the sound better since we were FM. Michael was brilliant, by the way. I mean, something as small as that. Let's take full advantage of our what we have over, say, an AM station that's not stereo. So it was a large JVC recorder, and it was a little bit bulky, but I would carry it to these events. And I came up with the microphone and was wanting to ask Jesse Helms a question. I don't recall exactly what the topic was, but he was not very happy about microphones in his face. And he just kind of bulled past me and knocked me over. I was young and slim at the time. I mean, I probably weighed 105 pounds. And he was a big, tall fellow. You know, not heavy set, but he knocked me over, not intentionally, but then I was fine, and everything worked out great.
You were knocked over by Jesse Helms. You're listening to Coastline. Jerry Nolan, Sharon Mahoney, thank you both so much for being with us today.
It was a pleasure to
thank
be
you.
Back at a microphone at WHQR. Thank you.
It's a journey through WHQR's 35-year history as we approach the actual birthday on April 22nd. When we return from the break, we'll meet two people who can tell us about the middle years, Barbara Sullivan and our own George Scheibner. Today's conversation is pre-recorded. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline, I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. It was a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens that created Friends of the Opera, which eventually became Friends of Public Radio, and launched WHQR. Now, 35 years later, WHQR has two signals, 91.3 FM, a dedicated news station, and 92.7 FM, an all-classical station. Joining me now to talk about the next couple of decades, Barbara Sullivan served on the board of directors for multiple terms and served as president of the board for part of her tenure. Barbara Sullivan, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
George Scheibner is WHQR's current operations manager and host of A Smooth Landing, which airs weeknights at 7 p.m. He's also the longest-serving WHQR employee in station history with seniority of 24 years. George Scheibner, welcome to the program.
Actually, it'd be 24 this coming November, but close enough.
In 2019, it'll be 24 years.
Yeah, they wrote me in just in time for the fall pledge drive.
Today's conversation is, of course, pre-recorded. And Barbara, we know you've been involved from the very, very early days, but you took on greater leadership roles in the 90s and the early aughts. When you helped to paint the refurbished diner in 1984 that would become the station's first home, did you imagine that one day you'd be board president?
No, absolutely not. I did not. And it was so much fun back then. It was a very small space. It was a sort of funky space. I have some recollection that we painted it a really bad color green. But that's when I first met Michael Titterton, whom I'm sure other people have spoken about, but he was the first station manager and really the leader who brought us from a very small fledgling organization into something very well established and well respected in the community. Actually, he and Priscilla Balaban, who was one of the founders, she and Teddy Stickney and John Coulter and Jerry Nolan are the ones that stand out in my mind. But anyway, Priscilla and Michael invited me to lunch, and I didn't know why. And then they asked me to be on the board. And then I think I was on the board for a year or two and kept asking questions. And when you do that, you end up absolutely becoming president. Because no one else wants to, probably. So I've learned that about boards. But I did that, and I also got, so that, I think I had 12 years altogether on the board, or possibly 13. But I also had a relationship which was, I'm not sure what the years would have been, but maybe in the early 2000s, I had an 8-year stint where I did a commentary, garden commentary. So I learned. George was my taskmaster. He would make me do it over and over and over again, my commentaries. But I learned a little bit about radio from the inside that way.
And George Scheibner, how did
Wait, do that over again.
How did you come to WHQR?
Oh, boy. I started in college radio in the late 60s up in Connecticut, and I worked in rock and roll radio in New Haven. For about 10 years, and then finally burned out on that and went back to grad school in Chapel Hill and ended up taking a degree, but also ending up in public radio at WUNC for about 5 years. And then from there to Davidson for a couple of years, 2 years at
And that was public
WNCW, radio. Yes. This is all public radio. And then down here in 1995.
1995, Michael Titterton lured you to Wilmington, North Carolina.
Michael and I shared a few pints at the statewide public radio conferences, and I came down to visit, and I liked the crew. They were small and feisty. They were fun. It was an oddball group of people, and that appealed to me because that was the kind of radio that where you had some freedom and you could be creative.
Barbara Sullivan.
Yeah, I think that it's so interesting looking back at what it used to be compared to what it is now. And I was looking at an article that someone wrote about NPR studios back in the 80s, and evidently it was a big dump. There was no lock on the door. And it was sort of almost like a group of college kids, not quite, but it was kind of spontaneous, experimental, artistic. So I think just in general across the country, first of all, NPR wasn't really well known. And they were making it up as they went along. And a lot of the local stations, including ours, but all over the country, were sort of figuring out what NPR should be. And I just wanted to say that when we started back in 1984, Wilmington was much smaller. It was around 54,000 population, something like that. And the most recent statistic is 119,000. So, first of all, there weren't even that many people to broadcast to. But also, I think people were not that familiar with what public radio was and what it had to offer.
And one of the things the station wanted to do was not only bring the Metropolitan Opera broadcast to Wilmington, but it was also about Morning Edition and All Things Considered.
Well, I think that as the when I-40 opened up, and that opened up, what, in 1990-some-odd, early-some-odd, that opened up a floodgate of people who came down to visit, go to the beach, like the area, ended up moving here or retiring here. So the population changed, and a lot of those people had listened to public radio elsewhere, and they quickly latched on to WHQR. So it's always had a solid base of people from not only here, but people who've come from elsewhere, and this has become their public radio station. Me too.
And as that's right, and as it's grown, it really spent most of its history being kind of a patchwork quilt of classical music, national news, some local news, local content, local music. George, describe the kind of music you do.
Whatever I'm interested in at the moment, whatever I happen to come across. I have all kinds of interests. I've done classical radio, I've done jazz, I've done pop and rock radio, I've done folk radio. Music is what interests me, and just finding good stuff. There isn't much thought being put into music programming these days. Even on the classical side, it's a big rotation of the war horses. And on pop radio, it's even worse. I mean, it's like top 40, but it's album cuts in top 40. And I started off doing a kind of radio where the person on the air had some leeway as to what he or she could play. And there's a way to put it together creatively, either getting music to match or expanding on a theme, usually not for too long, but connecting with the listener when suddenly that person out there says, hey, wait a minute, why did those two things go together? Oh, that's why. And they realize that there's a thinking person at the other end, too. And that's what appeals to me.
Pledge drives were very different back in the day. Barbara Sullivan, can you tell us, for people who just heard the 2019 spring pledge drive, how is that different from what used to happen when you were on the board?
It is so different. That was possibly the craziest and funniest time of the year and most stressful. There were tears often.
Tears,
yes. There would be volunteers leaving in tears. It was very stressful. First of all, I think the goals were, I want to say, maybe $30,000, $40,000, so at the beginning. And I was speaking to someone recently, and I think there were at least 20 years in a row where I hit every fall and spring pledge drive in the sense of being a volunteer, either answering phones or something. So I have a long history with the pledge drives. But originally, there was Pledge Central, and the walls were papered, all four walls, with these pieces of 8x11 Xerox paper, and each one had a different premium on it. So it could be someone offering dog grooming or psychic reading or a trip on a sailboat, and they would be numbered. And when the phones would ring, they'd call in and say, has premium number 186 been taken? And someone would run around and say, I don't know, where is it? And rip it off the wall. And it was pretty much pandemonium. And at some point, one of the staff who was in charge of membership, and I can't remember who it was, said, we are not having these premiums anymore. It was complete chaos, but it was fun. And anyone who called in to offer, you know, three free goldfish, we would put that up on the wall. Whatever, it didn't matter. There was no, absolutely no editing of those. But what was really fun and what people tuned in for were the fundraiser theater little presentations, which there were a lot of people at that time who were in acting. So you had Michael Titterton, Jamila Erickson, Eileen LeBlanc, Eric Paisley, and probably others I'm forgetting. And they would do such funny little skits, like cowboy skits, but it all had to do with WHQR. And they
corny is the word.
They were so funny, and they were so much fun. And so people would just tune in to listen to, you know, fundraiser theater. And it was a very wild and woolly. And then at the end, there was one person whom I won't name, but he knows who he is, who would come in the very last minute of the last day and just dump whatever was remaining that hadn't been made in the goal. And we always knew he would come in, and he would just come in. And
is he someone who's involved with the station now?
He is, I'm sure, still supports the station, but he's been on the board, and he was our savior.
To find out who this is after the
all right
after this segment. There were some dark days for the station, and there was a point when people thought it might have to become a repeater for WUNC. Current.org reported on it like this. Station leaders and employees, present and former, disagree about how the music news station got into its tailspin and whether it could have righted its course sooner. John Milligan, the ousted GM, contends that during his 2-year tenure, he was guiding the station toward prosperity. Others argue Milligan's plan to overhaul WHQR cost too much and worsened its already precarious financial situation. Again, that's from current.org. Either way, Barbara Sullivan, you and some other board members had to take over and figure out a way through. How did you do that?
Yes, that was quite a dramatic point in the life of the radio station. We were, maybe I won't say on the air, but we were in great, great deal of debt.
It was about $400,000?
It was actually, yeah, almost $500,000.
Almost $500,000, yeah.
And I guess people understand that we do not get programming free. We have to pay NPR, American Public Media, and all the other purveyors of programming. And we were in great debt to them. And of course, you have to keep the lights on, and you have to pay the staff. And things were really not looking good. And so a change was made. And at the time, we were getting a lot of advice from outside sources who were in the public radio world, but who came in literally from other states, like from, I think, there were a couple of gentlemen who came from the Midwest to sort of analyze what was going on and see what our future would be.
There was a consulting group called Strategeries.
Oh, okay. I didn't remember that was their name, but
yes, it's a name that comes from a TV parody of George W. Bush's malapropism.
That's very funny. Well, yeah. They were very nice, but they came.
So that was WHQR's consulting group.
That was our consulting firm, and we were
apropos.
We were actually offered by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting a sum of money to officially hire them or someone like them to tell us, you know, what we should do going forward, but. But the caveat was that if we didn't follow whatever their suggestion was, we'd have to give the money back. And since we didn't have any money to give back, we sort of decided that didn't seem like a good idea. So we had accountants and lawyers on the board. We had lots of smart people. We had Jeff Hovis, whom I believe you're going to speak to, who's our savior. There were quite a few people who rallied around, and we decided that the board would run the station temporarily, which I don't think had ever happened, I don't know, in the world of public radio. But we had been told by Strategeries and other people that that was absolutely impossible, could not happen, would not succeed. We would be out in the street, and we would be basically begging someone to take the station off our hands.
And it was another point in WHQR history when this small group of committed, thoughtful citizens said, we're going to do it. We're going to figure out a way through. I want to go back for a second. Peter Biello worked here as a reporter. He got his start in journalism here. He's currently host of All Things Considered at New Hampshire Public Radio. He was a grad student at UNC Wilmington, took an internship, and then went on to host Morning Edition for a year. So he learned reporting and hosting here before he went on. And he was very well-liked and well-respected, from what I understand. And he sent us this remembrance.
I remember I was reporting at HQR on election night 2008, the night Barack Obama was elected president. Mm-hmm. I remember it was a 20-hour day that day because I'd hosted Morning Edition that morning, and we didn't stop. We reported throughout the afternoon, bouncing. I remember driving back and forth between the Democratic Party headquarters in Brunswick County and the Republican Party headquarters in Brunswick County, trying to get people to talk to me, also phoning in sort of live man on the street kind of updates, the vibe in the room for the various politicians and parties. And that was really fun. It was fun to be part of the action. It was my first significant election night. And I'll just never forget at the end of the night driving home and listening to Barack Obama and John McCain give their speeches. And it was just great to be part of writing that first draft of history.
And that was Peter Biello, got his start in journalism here at WHQR as a reporter and then a morning edition host. Barbara Sullivan, you remember Peter.
I do remember Peter, yes.
And was it around that time that he, did he get away before the station started to kind of get into trouble?
Or? I can't remember the chronology. I'm not too good on remembering years, but...
He had finished up his grad studies at UNCW, and he'd gotten enough skills here that he was able to take a job in Vermont at Vermont Public Radio.
So that was his next move.
That was his next move.
And it was a good one.
And that's a lot of things that's done a lot in the medium.
You're listening to Coastline. Barbara Sullivan, George Scheibner, thank you both for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
When we come back from this break, former board member Jeff Hovis and current station manager Michelle Rinesmith join us. Today's conversation is pre-recorded. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline, I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Friends of the Opera succeeded in what looked like an impossibility. In 1984, they launched a public radio station based in Wilmington, North Carolina, as a community licensee. No university or larger institution to fall back on if the money didn't come. 35 years later, WHQR is still a community licensee and stronger than ever with two signals, one dedicated to news, which is what you're hearing now, 91.3 FM, and one dedicated to classical music in line with the founder's mission. That's 92.7 FM. Joining me now to take us through the rest of the dark years up to the very bright current state of affairs are Jeff Hovis, former member of the Board of Directors. Jeff Hovis, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you for having me.
And Michelle Rinesmith, current station manager. Welcome, Michelle Rinesmith.
Hi. Thank you, Rachel. Thank you for having me.
This conversation is pre-recorded. So, Jeff, when we left with Barbara Sullivan, who was also a board member during part of the time that you were on the board, we learned that the station had gone into very deep debt, and outside consulting firms, at least one of them, said, you really need to just give up the ghost and let this become a repeater. Let another station, a larger station, buy you.
Right. They had even started to introduce us to those people that could possibly take over.
And so why didn't you go down that road?
Well, it would have been the easiest way, but as hard as things were. But there was such a commitment to a large core of people that just said that people would come in with a little extra money. It would help with some fundraising that we decided, well, let's, you know, we have this debt. Let's find a way to manage it, or let's, you know, we're not alone, and I don't think they've ever had a program like this, so let's just try to find a way to maybe redirect that debt and find a way to stay successful and not drown in what we had going on.
So once again, and this was, I'm not sure how many years later, but the station started with this group of thoughtful, committed citizens who said, we're going to do this, even though consultants are telling us it's not possible. And then a couple of decades later, at least, it happened again. You're faced with a situation where consultants are saying the way through is not there.
Right.
And so what did you do?
Well, one of our biggest issues was the cost of programming. So one of those vendors was NPR. So I got in my car and drove to Washington, parked it in Mass Avenue, walked in, said, hey, I'm here to see our account executive and a couple other people. And they said, well, you know, are they expecting you? I'm like, I told them I was coming, but I don't know if they're expecting me. But I showed up and I said, I'll wait here for them.
So you didn't have an appointment?
And they wouldn't really give me one, but I told them I was going to come. And they said, you know, stop by anytime. You know, we'll be happy to talk with you. So I took them on their word and I got there and they brought me in. We sat down. We had a very good conversation and basically just said, for us to continue this programming, we have to work something out. And ultimately we did.
So I just want to make sure that we're painting this picture clearly. When you got there, you let them know that you weren't going to leave until you actually saw them eyeball to eyeball.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. They knew that I wasn't going to leave. They were sort of, who is this man sitting in our lobby? They knew they had to talk with me.
So you negotiated a deal with NPR.
We did, yes.
And you also negotiated with the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and Public Radio International. Tell us about that.
Both those, they both told us if we could get NPR to get on board with that, then they would follow. So when NPR came on board and we worked that out, we went over to those and we were able to work out deals that were very beneficial too, because we wanted to continue the programming, but we told them we had no choice. It's either work with us or we're going to be not able to carry some of those programs. And they really were very willing to work with us. And then the board that came in behind was able to we negotiated a deal that had a certain payments going forward. We were very, very low on the payments, and they would elevate. And it was very fun to see that years after we negotiated that, we were debt-free, you know, when it was
announced. How long did it take? How many years?
Gosh, I want to say 4.5, 5 years. It was
isn't very long when you consider you're almost $500,000 in debt.
Yeah. And we were lucky because we were able to sort of negotiate some of that away. And I think after that, some other radio stations reached out to us on that.
And I want to talk about Cleve Callison in a second because you were part of the group that hired him. But first, why do you think that NPR and PRI and CPB were willing to work with you? I mean, you guys, under your watch, it went into debt to the tune of almost $500,000. What made them want to trust you further?
Well, I think, one, we owned up to it. We saw that, you know, we had gone under. It was a time when everybody was going like, oh, this can never happen. We won't have a decline. The economy, it will recover. There's like, you know, we earned this last year. Of course we'll earn that plus. Well, when we came to it, I mean, we had spreadsheets. We had a, you know, plan, succession plan, and we just put it all together. And they saw that we showed how we could do it. And we showed that if we didn't get to certain parts, what we would need to take out of it.
And you really had to take over running the station because you let the manager go at the time, who some would argue played a big role in the debt, in creating the debt. You let go lots of station employees at the time. And so you and Jeff Hunter, who was a board member, he's now an employee at WHQR, Barbara Sullivan, Rob Zappel, who is still a board member at WHQR and a New Hanover County Commissioner now, you guys ran the station.
We did. We took turns. I had a schedule of when we'd be there so that we could answer questions. You know, we were reaching out to people in the community. If there was someone that wanted to give a gift, we're like, where can we meet you? And so we were here, and plus, we had made those decisions to terminate those positions, so we felt that we needed to have a group of us that would oversee that the extra work or try to do it as much as we could. It was, you know.
You were doing this as board members and volunteers.
Yes.
And you were also getting the message from the community, we don't want to see this station become a repeater. We want this to stay local.
Right. A lot of people were, as soon as it was mentioned that we may become part of the larger university system that might be in our state, that people were like, what do we need to do to help? And that was nice because you started seeing pledge drives work and we'd see some funds come in where, you know, at one point we had a board meeting where I had enough votes to actually vote to have us to consider the repeater. And I gave my votes to Jeff Hunter so that we would be able to move forward with that.
Now, as part of the recovery, you stabilized the station and then you hired Cleve Callison, who has left quite a legacy. And I just want to, first of all, play a message that we have from him.
Hello, I'm Cleve Callison. It was my great honor and privilege to serve as station manager of WHQR from 2010 to 17. It was the best job I ever had. I had the opportunity to make a difference for WHQR and this community by working with a great board, a dedicated staff, and a committed listener base. Thanks to a lot of hard work by a lot of people, we eliminated a $400,000 debt that came frighteningly close to bankrupting the station. And we went on from there to raise over $2 million in a capital campaign that let us start the Legacy Society, purchase our facilities on Front Street, and sign on Classical HQR in Wilmington, Southport, and Myrtle Beach, and an HQR news repeater in Myrtle Beach. It really was a great ride. And yes, I am enjoying retirement. Congratulations to WHQR on its 35th anniversary, and thanks for your feedback.
That was former station manager Cleve Callison. He's referring to a segment he used to produce called Friday Feedback. And thanks also to Cleve Callison for the archival sound that we got of WHQR's original sounds on the air and the introduction from Michael Titterton. So you hired Cleve, and his mandate, Jeff Hovis, was?
We go forward, find a way to be profitable, continue on this program to continue to reduce our debt. I started to rotate off the board, but stayed a little bit involved. Part of it was to go into the ability of buying our space, because if we continued to show improvement, lack of debt, then if we could purchase the space, it was a game changer for the station, I believe.
Michelle Rinesmith, when you arrived, you've been here a little more than a year and a half now, I think. Mm-hmm. The station was in excellent shape financially, so it was your mandate to take the station to the next level. Evolve
yes.
even further. What does that mean to you?
Well, I mean, we just, back in November, we launched our new logo, and we're WHQR Public Media, because we're more than just a radio station. We have our app, we have the website. So that was the first thing. And it's taking a look at our facilities and upgrading our equipment and addressing those needs.
You've really been pulling the station from the 20th century into the 21st century from a technology point of view.
And I've tried to. I mean, I've had that experience coming from the stations that I worked at in Florida, where the equipment was top grade. And so it was like, okay, well, we need to do this, and this is how we're going to do it. And it's not doing it all at once, but doing it gradually. Because what I want to do is to enhance the overall sound of the station. And I want to do that in a way that you're not going to notice it. It's just going to be a gradual thing, and you're going to be like, oh, wow. And, I mean, the station sounds fantastic, but I think it can even sound better.
And you also brought Jamila Erickson out of retirement and back to classical music. And many listeners, big fans, 30 mm-hmm. seconds left. Tell us how you lured her out of retirement and why.
It was easy. She was ready to come out of retirement. I think it was just the perfect timing. You know, I sent her an email and I said, hey, Jamila, would you like to have lunch? And we did. And I was like, would you like to come back? And she's like, yes. So it was that easy. And yes, she's a wonderful voice and a wonderful talent.
And that's this edition of Coastline. Michelle Rinesmith, Jeff Hovis, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks also to Jerry Nolan, Sharon Mahoney, Barbara Sullivan, George Scheibner, Cleve Callison, and the countless numbers of people who have made WHQR what it is today. Coastline's producer is Rachel Keith. Production manager is Caitlin Hanrahan. Ken Campbell is technical director. Caitlin Freund is web and social media master. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.